Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. My name is Gabriel, and I'm here to motivate people to take an active role in building a better digital future. A big part of building a better digital future, in my mind, is really wrestling with the fine details of both privacy and decentralization. Well, unfortunately these days, much of the cryptocurrency ecosystem has been taken over by what is called in this conversation, moonboyism, overly fixating on price and profits rather than actual emancipatory technologies. The good news is there are still many people in the cryptocurrency ecosystem who are seriously dedicated cyber rebels. I had the opportunity to have a great conversation with one such cyber rebel, Anti-Moonboy. He recently wrote Darknet Market Maximalism, a counter-economics manifesto that describes the concrete advantages of peer-to-peer digital cash. And I'm a huge fan of his podcast series, Anti-Moonboy News. I hope you'll enjoy our conversation about the fine details of the cryptocurrency ecosystem, where we are now, what we can expect moving forward, but more importantly, what are the kinds of things we should pay attention to? I've been very happy lately to be talking to many people who absolutely walk the walk when it comes to decentralization, and it's so gratifying to have a conversation with somebody who is so knowledgeable about one of the better tools in the space right now. I hope you'll enjoy our conversation, and by all means, feel free to reach out to either of us if you have any questions.
I'm curious what you are all about. Like, what brings you to publishing and engaging in these discussions in cryptocurrency in general?
Yeah, it was kind of a slow burn over the past decade. I first used cryptocurrency because I wanted to bet on UFC fights. And at the time, gambling was illegal in the United States, basically. So I bought some Bitcoin to do that. And from there, I kind of just slowly started to discover like how awesome peer-to-peer cash was. And for me, like, I'm drawn to cryptocurrency because of the utility. You know, the fact that you can use something and send value of something without it being censored or prevented. And I think that's a really valuable concept for us to have, not only for now, but for the future generations that will need something like that. So I'm really passionate about preserving that, promoting peer-to-peer cash, expanding it, and ultimately to get away from the speculative monstrosity of what cryptocurrency has, you know, become today. So my channel, Anti-Moonboy, is, you know, basically a channel dedicated to the promotion of peer-to-peer cash without any of that price sensationalism that is plaguing cryptocurrency. We're not just looking at price charts. In fact, we're not looking at price charts at all. my channel promotes digital cash as a valuable tool that everyone we need, as it's a human rights issue as far as I'm concerned. All my content is on antimoonboy.com, by the way, if you want to check it out. But I have a weekly podcast called Anti-Moonboy News that airs every Monday, and a lot of education on that as well. But ultimately, what has drawn me to at least observing darknet markets, because I have written about them recently in Darknet Market Maximalism, is that darknet markets, they represent the oldest and largest peer-to-peer market that only exists because of decentralized cryptocurrency. And that's a really fascinating concept because, again, 95 to 99% of cryptocurrency usage today is number go up. Oh, we're all going to the moon. We're all going to be rich. But in this case, you have just like regular people who are like going out of their way to buy cryptocurrency as a utility. And yeah, that's just, that's completely in contrast to, you know, how cryptocurrency is viewed by most people.
Right. And for me, that's why you're a very important speaker in this space, because you get away from just the kind of price insanity, which seems tied to so many nefarious aspects of the space, which is tragic because there is real potential. You know, I got interested in Bitcoin because people were talking about it as freedom tech, and I learned how to self-host, ironically, after learning about Bitcoin. You know, I started learning how to take more control by technology, and to me, it was kind of a gateway into that. But then over the years, you see the cryptocurrency entire ecosystem change into an entirely different community, what you got to call the moon boys. And to me, the most frustrating thing about the Moon Boys is that their attitude, you know, how to be a Moon Boy is simple. You buy a token and then you start spamming everybody on Twitter that it's the next thing that will change society and everything. And then you just kind of try to hope you can profit off other people jumping into it. And what's sad is that it kind of like completely disconnects people from the real things these tools were supposed to solve. You know, many people, when especially when I was first getting interested in Bitcoin as a discussion, is people were talking about, hey, this is uncensorable money. And with all the demonetization and deplatforming that was going on, that was a real pressing conversation. And now who cares if BlackRock's buying Bitcoin? Who cares if Michael Saylor is the, you know, the vanguard of really pushing for how can big corporate finance take over this space? And so I'm curious where you've kind of encountered that. Like, what is Moonboyism to you, and where do you see it most prevalent?
The best example of this is contrasting the early days of the Silk Road, where it was edgy, and the Silk Road, and it was just like terrifying, right? And I mean that in like a, not like a spooky, but like it was like, whoa. You know, world changing kind of, it's a world changing kind of concept where you have decentralized money. And contrast that to Michael Saylor's headshot on Forbes magazine. It's so sterile. It's pathetic. He just looks like a total clown, right? And for what it's worth, this guy already was like, he already had to pay like hundreds of millions in fines during the dot-com bubble. So he's just redoing that right now, right? But anyways, yeah, you have these vultures that have come into Bitcoin and they've turned it into this just money-making operation where like all they care about is just, yeah, making money. And they don't really care about any of the, you know, the cypherpunk idealism that got us here in the first place. You know, you look at like Satoshi and like, and the Genesis block, what did he say? The banks are on the second, what was it? It was a,
there was a bailout.
The bailout of the second banks on the brink of it, right? And it was like targeted towards like, hey, listen, banks, they are, you know, controlling, or fiat, currency, right? And the way banks work and everything involved with that, it's out of our control, right? Like we can't do anything about it and we're stuck in this system. And now we have something like Bitcoin where it's this open source project where everyone's on a level playing field and we can all contribute to it, right? And it's just a really powerful concept of freedom, right? But yeah, the Moon Boys, they've really come in and now these days it's not even really about anything about freedom or liberty or open source protocols or anything. Most people don't run their own node. I don't think like 99% of people are like just holding their cryptocurrency on like a KYC exchange. I mean, it's, you have like soccer moms down the street, you know, talking about Bitcoin. Well, I mean, that's not, they totally can talk about Bitcoin. I'm not saying they can't, but it's just like they haven't heard the phrase open source software in their entire life. Okay, let's be honest here. They're right. They're not in this for the freedom. They're in this because of the number go up, which is fine. And to be clear to your audience too, like I'm not saying like investment's a bad thing. Like that's totally a legitimate use case of cryptocurrency. But the problem with Moonboyism is they only care about the number going up. They only want to get rich. And because of that, they will compromise on many of the things we fought so hard to preserve, such as, you know, the freedom to spend your money how you want to spend your money without dealing with KYC, which is know your customer. Like things like that, where you're giving away your identity and therefore tying your identity to a transaction.
Well, it's funny to me how many times in the cryptocurrency space, especially with, like you say, the more mainstream you get these days, there is a weird recreation of everything we're supposed to be fighting against. We don't like, you know, how central banks manipulate the money supply. And as far as I'm concerned, proof of stake is just a digital central bank. I actually don't see any benefits to using a token where, you know, the big holders have control over everything. And you see the same kind of censorship going on with the tokens where it's like there's no privacy. So people can discriminate on blacklist transactions. And like, I get it that there are, you know, seedy aspects of all this that people want to fight. But at the same time, once you start compromising on decentralization and privacy, you have to ask yourself what the point of all this fundamentally is, because many, you know, crypto critics in the early days would say just run a database. You know, centralized services can do all the same censorship and controlling flows a lot easier. It's not a complicated thing to pull off. And so I think to the degree, you know, we really want peer-to-peer cash. And I think the reason that peer-to-peer digital cash is such a game changer nowadays is because people have forgotten, like you say, you know, the because when you first entered Bitcoin, as like when it was a niche thing or many of these cryptocurrency discussions, you would have to learn what these things were just to kind of know what you're talking about. But now it's been so polished and refined that you can interact with a cryptocurrency like system without understanding any of the, you know, digital freedom foundations that many people say in my situation would take for granted. And it's hard to disambiguate it. And for instance, you know, KYC, a lot of people don't really understand why KYC, having to give your ID to a crypto exchange to buy and sell doesn't sound like a big deal to many people. They're like, this is just how it's done, right? But then recently Coinbase had their support staff being bribed to hand over, a bunch of information on people. And that's the thing that concerns me the most, is you have this consolidation of information on people. And I feel like that's the real point of all this. I feel like much of the mainstream crypto space is hostile to people's not just digital freedoms, but actual freedoms. And you see this in the stablecoin space. And I'm kind of curious, with the passing of the Genius Act, like, what are your thoughts on the whole stablecoin situation in general?
Well, before we talk about stablecoins, I do want to talk about KYC a little more, because this is like a really important topic. So when it comes to like privacy and cryptocurrency, KYC is the biggest threat to privacy, bar none. It, like, a lot of times when you get like different, they call themselves privacy coins. They're just different cryptocurrencies with privacy. They debate about like, oh, we're more private than you. It doesn't really matter that much, because what's really happening is, in a lot of these like darknet market busts, they're just looking at KYC exchanges, because you just like hemorrhage metadata when you're using these exchanges. And from a privacy perspective, just in general, these websites are terrible. And like, as you said, Coinbase, they had employees like in India or whatever, like just like selling like all of this information. I don't know why these people had access to so much information.
Right.
Total train wreck. And I mean, you're going to see people getting wrench attacked. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to all the wrench attacks that have been happening over the last 6 months. Freaking insane. There's like hostage situations and like people getting their fingers cut off. And it's crazy. So like, KYC exchanges just in general, like, you can use them. It's not the end of the world. But you have to really know that you're giving away a lot of information about yourself, and this is uncensorable money. So, and there's a lot of sick people out there, right? And I don't think a lot of people are putting two and two together. Furthermore, it doesn't even have to be like a wrench attack, right? It could just be, you know, like an old person getting tricked, right? And that has happened many times, where they get called by support service or whatever, then they give their seed phrase away. It's actually very simple to do, because like, this is a novel technology and people don't really understand how it works. Ironically enough, this is actually, you know, pushing people towards more centralization, because they don't want to handle the cryptocurrency, because they don't want that responsibility. So it's just really important though to understand, like, this is really the battleground that's happening right now. And so, you know, Monero, for example, is not really listed in a lot of places. And that's actually not really a problem as far as I'm concerned, because it, like when you're listed on a lot of these places, it makes attacking it a lot easier. That being said, there's good things that come along with being listed on exchanges, like, you know, a price increase is good for the network, a better mining network, more people developing your cryptocurrency, like working on it, etc. There are like reasons to like want to have Monero or whatever cryptocurrency on different exchanges. But at the same time, from a privacy perspective, we have to like make it clear that these exchanges are very detrimental to your privacy.
Right. And that's where I really like your treatise, Darknet Market Maximalism, because it's really highlighting the point that even if you're not interested in, say, seedy economic activity that we don't want to have any part in, the fact of the matter is that darknet markets are a useful place to understand what actually is working for people fundamentally. So if you know, I call it a primer on counter economics, because if you have, let's just say, different priorities than your government, and many people do, many people are in an adversarial relationship with their governments. And with all the censorship and control that's going on right now, it is really important to think of ways outside of these structures if you want to actually support independent creators, support, you know, real independent research on breaking issues that they don't want people to know about. I guarantee you paying journalists to go into, you know, various war zones right now is a very difficult thing to do. And are you going to worry about what's hypothetically perfect, or are you going to use what works? And I really love the pragmatism you describe in Darknet Market Maximalism, because it's not just about, you know, you're not like some Monero maxi telling everyone, oh, Monero is and always will be the perfect solution. You're like, no, let's pragmatically look at what works and figure out how we apply it. And I think this is a generalizable idea to tech freedom across the board. Instead of getting bogged down into really silly fights about which technology is better than this, it is worth considering what are the best practices, or what are the tools that actually can be leveraged to accomplish what we want.
Yeah, exactly. And to be clear, like, we're not promoting darknet markets. There's a lot of sick people out there, okay? Like,
right.
Like, the thing is, these are markets, again, where people, they actually need cryptocurrency. And there's not really many markets like it. Like, if I want to buy, like, I don't know, like a computer, there's many ways I can buy a computer. I don't need cryptocurrency for that, right? And like, if I want to buy cat food, right? I don't need cryptocurrency for that. But if I want to buy like cocaine, I need cryptocurrency for that. That's the difference. And you have people who, by the way, do not care about the price of cryptocurrency. That's irrelevant to them. They are looking at cryptocurrency like it's gas for their car. You know, it's a thing that they need to get, right? It's just another thing that a check on the checklist that they have to do. They don't have like any attachment to it other than the fact that it gets them from point A to point B. And so, yeah, this is just completely different than like other things in cryptocurrency, because again, it's just people like Michael Saylor doing dumb things, and it's just like, oh my gosh, super cringe. Gonna just expand on your, you know, point about like, you know, the pragmatism and like looking at darknet markets in like a different way. And the quote that I have from Darknet Market Maximalism is that the difference from the perspective of the state, the drug dealer is no different than the privacy advocate. In fact, the privacy advocate is probably more dangerous to the state. And you need to have that perspective when you're thinking about peer-to-peer cash, or just in general, because like, yeah, drug dealers or whatever, they're a dime a dozen, but someone who like is an individual who's like fighting the system on a ideological, you know, playing field, that's a completely different ballgame, because we're in the right. You know what I mean? Like we're like fighting for human rights on our side. So that I encourage people to look at it in that way, because like, I know a lot of people are like, oh, we don't want this association with darknet markets. I get it, but they don't care about you, right? The state really doesn't care about you at the end of the day, or at least they kind of care about you, but mostly for your tax money.
Right. And it's frustrating to see, like, especially with this latest Trump election, so many people are willing to kind of like just adopt a sense of complacency. And you see this because, you know, power corrupts. And so a lot of people will think that, oh, you know, all the problems are fixed. But it's like, really, how far are we away from, say, another, you know, medical scare where suddenly, you know, the censorship goes off the rails and it's very hard to fund independent research on life-saving matters? You know, I don't think any of these issues are abstract after what has happened over the last couple of years. And it's concerning first and foremost because many people don't want to consider that, like, it's such a typical problem nowadays where people ask, say, a particular creator or influencer, why don't you take cryptocurrency? And most of the things I hear from other people who have like medium-sized audiences is that nobody actually donates or nobody actually purchases things through cryptocurrency because it's actually hard to get enough people using it. And well, how are you going to get people to use it if it's unusable or too abstract and whatever? And so it is very important. And my principal motivation in a lot of this stuff is I think we need to build better tools to give people privacy. That was the original Cypherpunk manifesto, you know, Cypherpunk's right code. And, you know, there are many projects that can be built. And one of the things I've really been digging into in the last couple of years is that the bar for real meaningful change is actually way lower if you think about it in those terms. If you think about it, what can I give to somebody to make things a little bit better? And, you know, you see some of this, you know, for instance, the Noster space is full of people trying to experiment with different things. And I saw an interesting project called Start 9, where it's like they're trying to sell a commercial product that makes self-hosting, you know, easier. And I'm not going to say the project's perfect or anything. I definitely have my own reservations, but the concept of, hey, let's build something that actually makes this idea easier is important. And so when it comes to, like you say, thinking about things from a, you know, darknet perspective, it's like really the fact that you're right. The government doesn't distinguish between somebody who's fighting for human rights or privacy or even other, you know, serious causes that people care about and, you know, all the people they kind of, you know, track down on. And so it is a serious concern. And I'm curious because you're very like a advanced, you know, Monero user. Like a lot of what I learned from about Monero has been from you. And like, you have a fair bit of like educational content. I know you mentioned new stuff is coming there, but what do you think people need to like really grasp when it comes to like, you've got somebody fresh, they have no idea about any of this stuff. What should they know about, you know, cryptocurrency if you were giving them from a blank slate?
About Monero or just in general?
Either.
Okay, yeah. So we'll talk about Monero then. I would first start with just saying it's secret money, right? It's digital cash. It's money that doesn't have you know, a corporation doing anything. It's money that we control. It's decentralized money is a better way to put it, where we, the royal we, like as a community, we control it, right? And not only that, it's money that doesn't have a political opinion, and which is probably going to be very popular for people because people are just tired of like, you know, political conversations are the worst, right? But like in this case, there it's not, you can't stop a transaction if you want to do something, right? And I don't know, I mean, in general, I think a lot of people can really grasp that, right? I think a lot of people can, you know, like, if I, like, I've talked to people in person many times about cryptocurrency, and like 9 times out of 10, they're like on board with that kind of concept. The problem, though, is that extra step where it's like they're going to use it regularly. And we're just not at a point where people want to do that. It's kind of like you have to convince somebody that they want to use Monero or Bitcoin instead of Venmo. And it's kind of like that's really hard because that's super convenient for them. They have it tied to their bank account. They can just send money instantly. It essentially is a form of peer-to-peer cash. So like we have to kind of, you know, stay true to our principles and just say, listen, that can get censored. You know, that can get, you know, they can collect data about you. A lot of people don't care. But like, in my opinion, that's the best way to do it, because what we're doing is we're upholding the principles. We're not promising anything extraordinary or promoting something that like is being used. And, you know, again, like the reason I talk about darknet markets, and I actually do this with people who are like, you know, completely new to cryptocurrency, I'll tell them like, yeah, Monero is actually being used on darknet markets instead of Bitcoin to like buy drugs on the internet. And I'm telling you, every single time, the reaction I get is that kind of like wide-eyed, like, oh, that reaction. It's not ew. No, it's like, ooh. Kind of like Tony Soprano. Like if Tony Soprano walks into a restaurant, right? What are you doing? You're like, oh, Tony's here. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's, you put respect on the name. It's kind of similar to that regard where you respect that. There's that clout there, right? And so that would be my selling point, where it's like, listen, at the end of the day, if we're 20 years in the future, right, you're going to want to invest at least a little time into learning about peer-to-peer cash, because it's our way to hedge against some sort of like very dystopic type of government. And as proof of that, we have right now economies where people depend on it. And, you know, I'm telling you right now, it works every single time. Now, the stigma there is real for sure. Like and a lot of people don't like that association, completely understandable, but we're just looking at this in a, you know, pragmatic kind of viewpoint. That's usually how I do it, because, you know, just telling them, oh, he uses random X, and like the people, like they don't care about the technology. It's just like going to go right over their head. They want to know about other people using it, because they don't want to be the only loser who's like holding the bag, right? And when they hear about like actual legitimate adoption, that's a game changer, in my opinion. The focus for every project really should be about adoption. And it's really no surprise why Monero is punching above its weight in adoption in all markets, for what's worth, not just darknet markets, also clearnet markets. Monero's adoption is far above other cryptocurrencies. And that's because use Monero has been an adage that has been preached from the beginning.
I'm curious to go into some of the technical details.
Sure.
Why do you think Monero is scaling better than Bitcoin for being actually usable? Because I remember, you know, for instance, Bitcoin would get so popular, fees would shoot straight to the sky. And suddenly, you know, that's where the whole store of value narrative kind of came from, was that people eventually realized fees would kind of cripple it. Are Monero fees substantially different than Bitcoin? I'm kind of curious if you're aware of any specific, either technical or even just otherwise, changes to the project that makes Monero easier to use than Bitcoin.
Yeah, Monero has what are called dynamic block sizes. So the thing with Bitcoin, so let's talk about Bitcoin first and how it works. Bitcoin has a limited block size. And because of that, you have to bid into the block. So if there's a lot of usage of Bitcoin at a time, if like the network's really popular, that transaction fee is going to be really high because there's only a limited amount of space to fit your transaction in that block. Now, actually, right now, no one's really using Bitcoin. So this problem...
Which is the irony, yeah.
Which is the irony, right? But here's the problem with that, though. It actually works the other way around, because block rewards for Bitcoin are declining over time. And if the block rewards are going down, the miners, they want a profit still. So what are they going to do? They're going to raise the transaction fees. That's the only way that they can make a profit, right? And so because of that, over time, they're going to become more and more reliant on transaction fees, which is a problem because this store of value narrative is what's being promoted. So it's actually like really bad. And yeah, I'm not really sure how they're going to like fix it, because like people just like aren't really using Bitcoin. The Lightning Network statistics are pretty abysmal. Maybe it has ticked up a little bit recently, but it's like nowhere near what we've been promised for since like what, 2016. They've been calling it like the future. It's no one's really using Lightning Network. And that's because they're being sold this narrative of, you know, hodl your Bitcoin, get a second mortgage, sell your kidney, you know, hold as much Bitcoin as possible. Michael Saylor literally told people to sell kidneys. I mean, he's probably joking, but I'm not even sure anymore. Like, you know what I mean? Like the guy's crazy. Yeah, whatever. But anyways, that's all happening. But it's just like, why would you then use your Bitcoin, right? If you're just hearing that all the time. And that's how most people are entering the space. Now with Monero, there is no cap on the block size. So the blocks can actually increase if more transactions come in. This is actually weighed down by this thing called tail emission. So I'm sure you're aware of this. Monero has continuing block rewards till the end of time, right? And a lot of people label this as infinite supply, which is, it's not infinity, but it's a low planned inflation over time. Now, right, there's going to be less Monero than Bitcoin until the year 2040. So this is not like a huge amount of inflation. It's actually only 0.6 Monero every 2 minutes until the end of time. And that percentage is going to go down, right? Because of, what do you call that with this numbers? I forgot the mathematical term, but
there's
like,
an asymptote for sure. Yeah.
That's what it is. That's what it is. Thank you. It's going to actually go down over time, right? The percentage of inflation on a year-to-year basis. Now, the way this is regulated, right? Because miners are the ones putting transactions in the blocks. But here's the thing. If the miners attempt to jam more transactions into a block to like take advantage of like transaction fees, they actually get penalized and they lose that some of that block reward, making it like not financially good for them, right? Because they're going to get penalized. So that block reward actually gets burned and it's lower than 0.6 Monero. So we actually have like a built-in mechanism to like preserve that. So like if there are a lot of transactions, temporarily the fees will go up, but also the block size will increase. And it kind of just like levels itself out over time. And the miners will participate correctly, because otherwise they're going to lose out on the block reward. And it kind of just like slowly ebbs and flows with like the usage rates. And that's a much better model than what Bitcoin has, because Bitcoin is entirely dependent on transaction fees. And over time, they're not even going to really be dependent on block rewards at all.
Right.
Unless the number goes way, way up. That's the only catch, yes, though. So I should point that out. But, you know, we're already seeing diminishing returns a year. Like, I'm not convinced that we're going to see, you know, the projections that Michael Saylor is saying. I'm not convinced at all about that. But if Michael Saylor does see his future, then maybe it will work out. So.
Well, in hindsight, I am kind of convinced Bitcoin was kind of built in with an expiry date, because a lot of people are very upset when they introduced the block cap on Bitcoin and then kept it for so long. I remember the block size wars, and I want to say around 2014, 2016, and it was a big deal. It was a very contentious issue in the space, and it was interesting to see kind of all the social dynamics going on at the time. Many people will talk about hijacking Bitcoin. I haven't read the book myself. I just was paying attention at the time. So that's kind of my knowledge into that. And it was so frustrating because, like you say, you know, people were promised that Lightning Network would fix all the scaling issues. People were told, yeah, oh, just put up with the small block size because we've got the solution. And in hindsight, it hasn't really panned out. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, because I've mostly paid attention to the Bitcoin side of this, where on Bitcoin, your fees are paid in Bitcoin. This is kind of the case in any cryptocurrency. But because the purpose of Bitcoin nowadays is for the price to go up, you know, indefinitely, that means if the fees are static, which is what the finite block size does, then you're always going to be paying more in fiat, which is going to be a serious problem for, you know, smaller users over time. And so I'm kind of convinced that that was almost like the plan from the beginning. Okay, we're going to cap the block size. We're going to keep people from increasing it so that as the fees rise, it basically becomes completely unusable. And it's kind of funny that as that has happened, now they're talking about rolling out CBDCs. Now they're talking about rolling out stable coins. And to me, the difference between a CBDC and a stablecoin isn't really that real. I'm like, is it by one guy or is it from, you know, some other cabal here? And I'm curious on your thoughts, especially as, you know, an American, on the Genius Act and the stablecoin push that's going on right now.
Well, yeah, you said it all right there with, you know, saying that stablecoins and CBDCs, there's no difference. There is no difference. We've been hearing about CBDCs now for the past 5 years, and like, it's very unpopular, right? So the government, they just rebranded it. The government was just like, hey, hold on. There's already companies that people use stablecoins for, like Tether. Let's just make them regulated. And everyone's like, yeah, let's just do that. That works. And that's what they literally just did. Like, so Tether is going to have all these regulations. They're going to be doing tons of chain analytics on people using, you know, whatever. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see over the next couple years, like, the developments in that front. But one thing to add to that is, you know, Bitcoin, yes, it's turned into basically what is a tech stock. I view Bitcoin as just a tech stock now. People aren't really treating it seriously. With the exception of some cypherpunks left in Bitcoin, for example, Ashigaru is a great project. There's some like really good cypherpunks still working on Bitcoin. Few and far between, unfortunately, though, because most people are, you know, obsessed with, you know, number go up, right? But if you are somebody who like is interested in cryptocurrency, but you're also interested in number go up, stable coins are kind of like the segue for you, right? That's kind of like the next step. And it's not just for those people. It's also just for regular people in general. And I've heard this anecdotally for what it's worth from friends of mine on the internet and stuff. Like, stable coins are actually quite popular in Latin America. They're quite popular in like the Middle East because they are pegged to the dollar. And it's basically like holding dollars. That's fantastic for them, right? They want that. They don't want the volatility of something like Bitcoin or Monero. Because of that, stablecoins are quite popular. And I, to be honest with you, like, I do see stablecoin adoption growing over time relative to other cryptocurrencies. I don't see why not. It's basically just using cash, and people already do that. So it's not really a hard sell. So yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see more and more rollouts of like these different types of stablecoin initiatives. Only a few are going to win out at the end, probably. Like Tether will always be around, and, you know, other major companies like that. But I mean, I'm sure like BlackRock has like some sort of stablecoin in the works. Maybe they invested in Tether. I don't even know. It's a deep rabbit hole, man. But but yeah, with stablecoins, I do see them becoming quite popular. And even in like underground illicit usage, you know, darknet market maximalism just talks about drug markets, the kind of traditional Silk Road-esque drug market, which we can, you know, pretty easily find through like Dread or Tor or whatever. I'm not going to like give a guide on how to find these markets. It's it's legal and easy. Don't worry about it. But anyway, the thing is like, With actual stablecoin usage, you're seeing like a lot of like, you know, for example, in China, there are these markets that were shut down on Telegram recently, and they were selling like scams and like, it wasn't even like ransomware. I think it was just like malware scams or whatever. They were just using Tether and like, or at least stablecoins. They weren't using Bitcoin. They weren't using Monero. They're just using stablecoins. And I've seen that not only in China, also Mexican cartels are laundering money with stablecoins. It's just very liquid and it's pegged to the dollar. So it actually makes a lot of sense that that's going to be used a lot.
Right. And that's why, for instance, one of the big talking points on the CBDC front by all the, you know, public-private partnerships talking about it was financial inclusion. The idea that you could give someone financial access by just having them install an app or something. And that's a whole lot easier than, let's just say, the traditional finance systems where you go to a bank, you sign up for a bank account, et cetera, et cetera. And what I find fascinating about the crypto space right now is with all the mainstreaming side of it. You know, I understand the cyber dissident, the cyber rebel side of cryptocurrency. What I struggle to understand these days is kind of the more moon boy side. I struggle to understand the Michael Saylor use case because, you know, banks could just have payment APIs that allows you to pay people with other bank accounts. Like, as far as working within the traditional finance system, I actually think none of these tokens are needed. But I think there may be a more insidious purpose in the sense that the goal is to bootstrap a new financial, you know, control system, because the biggest concerns people have with financial control when it comes to digital currencies is the ability for them to be turned off, blacklisted, tracked, censored, all that. Whereas the problem with legacy financial institutions is they're at least beholden to some laws. There is some due process. It's not a lot. I believe that part of the stablecoin push is that there is something nefarious to it. And what's funny is that you do see a lot of it come on the back of all these scams. For instance, the meme coin hype. You know, you had both Trump coin, Melania coin, a bunch of these other coins. And I kind of like how CoffeeZilla summarizes this as crime is legal now. It does seem like there's this new wild west of basically frauds and scams being done on people who are supposedly using decentralized infrastructure, but it's not decentralized. It's all mainstream. It's all, you know, centralized one way or another. I'm curious, what have you seen in this space as far as the more nefarious side of the mainstream crypto discussions?
Like the degenerate gambling?
Yeah.
A lot. It's if you go looking for it, it's really sad, to be honest with you. These people, they're just like, I think they're over leveraged. I think it's like all they have to live for, essentially. I don't know, man. It's really sad. Like, things like Pump Fun. I don't know if you were following that hype. Yeah, that was like weird, man. Some of it was hilarious, I won't lie. There was this one, for those who don't know, these were like meme tokens where people would buy and it would be like a game of chicken, because you're buying the token and waiting until someone dumps it, basically. It sounds crazy, but like literally people were doing this. That's how bored people are. And like, it's just gambling basically. And like, yeah, you would have people like dressing up and whatever, or like, you had this one guy in like a dog cage and he was like, if this coin gets to like $100,000 or stop, I'll start barking or whatever. Like it was like crazy. Like what? Not only that, I mean, obviously on social media, you have like, just like, really cringy kind of influencer types who, you know, they're just like, if they're even talking about something with like cypherpunk stuff, they're just LARPing. You know, it's very obvious as someone who like uses open source software all the time, like who's actually here for like the real stuff and like who's just here to make money, right? And yeah, to make money, I mean, it's not even just making money, because again, like I view like buying cryptocurrency as an investment totally fine, right? Like I, because for example, I like buying gold, like I in silver, I do. It's a nice little, every so often I'll just buy some. I like my shiny rocks, right? But like I'm not like throwing in a bunch of money on it and like, you know, being over leveraged and like staring at charts all day. And that's kind of the culture here, where you have people who are just trying to make it big so they don't have to work.
Yeah.
You know, they're just trying to get that quick buck. And let's be honest here. It's just, greed is just a human condition. It's just something that we all have. And, some people really have it bad, where like to compensate for not having a lot of money and also kind of just being not that self-aware, they'll just throw a bunch of money at something if you just give them like an elevator pitch, right? You'll have like a Charles Hoskinson, you know, tell them that this is the next Ethereum, and they'll just like give you $20,000, you know? And it's just, it's crazy, but like this happens like a lot. And it's happening to people who are like college educated too, like people who like should know better, but they get swindled into these like pump and dump scams. It's kind of just the sign of the times where you have just easy money everywhere and people have nothing else better to do, I guess.
I mean, I think everybody needs to listen. There's a little clip that's like stored in my mind forever of Sam Bankman-Fried explaining FTX. And he's like, you just put money in the box. And then when people buy the box, you know, the price of the box goes up. And so people, you get more money in the box. And he basically describes a Ponzi scheme, but just the way he makes it sound, I guess you could say innocuous to somebody who doesn't know better. It's kind of like, it destroys some of the illusion for me, because it's like that's really what's happening, is you're being told this is how you're going to make it. And I think a lot of these people probably are desperate, like you say, you know, it's like if you don't have a lot of money and you want to like make up for lost time, or if you're trying to somehow, you know, get ahead, you know, because you need to one way or another. Those are all very strong motivations, but it's a trap fundamentally. And or, you know, it's like I've got to tell people, if you're staring at charts all day and you're like, this is not your job and you've like, you know, mastered it, I'm sorry, you're doing something wrong. I've been there.
I would say too, like if you approach cryptocurrency from an idealistic perspective, like if you have even just a little of that, you can't lose, right? Because like, I mean, because at the end of the day, like I'm just supporting peer-to-peer cash. Now, granted, I've spent a lot of time on Monero. I would definitely be upset if there was like some like, you know, horrible bug that like destroyed everything. Chances of that happening are pretty low. There's a lot of people who are working on this project, but it could happen. Would my life be over if that happened? Absolutely not. I would keep working. I would keep grinding, right? Because really what I've discovered here is what a lot of other people have discovered is that this peer-to-peer cash, that's groundbreaking. We have to keep, you know, working on it and improving it, getting more people to use it if we can. Adoption is key here. So that's not going to go away anytime soon. And, you know, when you have people who are just like staring at charts all the time, they lose that. And if the number does go down for them, that's everything. And I mean, you have people who, I mean, this is horrible. They'll like kill themselves because of it. And I mean, you've seen that too. Like there's these, like if you want like some dark stuff, go to like any of these like Reddit, like subreddits of like old cryptocurrencies, and it's just a wasteland. And you like go to like their top threads from like 5 years ago, and everyone's just like, oh man, right. Moonboy Central, like, oh, I got all this bags and stuff. And you just can imagine how many people just got wrecked by that. And yeah, you don't hear the Moonboys talking when they're losing money, which is most of the time. Well, you only hear them when during the run up, right? But yeah,
there's a huge incentive to create these kind of predatory setups where like people are just being sent like lambs to a slaughter to be basically taken advantage of. And, you know, there was this big thing back, you know, where someone would be like, oh, I need to make a ton of money, so I'm just going to make a new coin. And now it's make a new meme coin. And it's a horrible problem as far as I'm concerned. But like you say, peer-to-peer cash is a tool and a thing we should really consider how we can take part in, because that is a completely different game than the rigged financial games that are out there. It's just tough because I can understand why it is confusing for people. For instance, I wrote a piece, the Xano conspiracy, hijacking privacy, because many people will use the language of privacy, use the language of peer-to-peer cash, use the language of all these things. But then when I watched the interviews by the creators responding to criticisms, you know, these are relatively minor criticisms you'll see. And then there'll be this kind of like flippant attitude of like, oh, that doesn't matter. And in my experience, when I see people working on serious, you know, open source projects and concerns are raised, it's usually a question of how are we going to fix this, not, oh, it doesn't matter, it's not a problem. And I've noticed you've kind of had some, you know, butted heads with the Xano community a bit in some of the discussions there. In fact, my piece actually links to an episode you did where it's like, what is Xano actually being used for? And you were talking about how Xano was really only used to talk about the price, even though in theory, this is a private cryptocurrency. And I'd love to have your thoughts on Xano and how the discussion of it has moved on over the last little bit.
Yeah, so the biggest red flag a privacy project can have is not caring about any sort of privacy vulnerability, or at least downplaying it. If you are ever involved in anything with privacy and they're just like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, really, you got to watch out, because like what you should be doing is the opposite. Like, yeah, this is a problem. We got to work on this. We got to do something about this. Like almost like the inverse of that, where they're taking it a little too seriously. You want that, right? And I'll give you an example. One of the main reasons I got so involved with Monero is the series called Breaking Monero. And it's literally Justin Ehrenhofer, who's a longtime community member, talking with the Monero Research Lab on how you can attack Monero. And it's what inspired me to make Attack of the Poison Outputs, which is basically the reboot of that series with, you know, 5 more years of data that we can look at and innovations and all that. But anyways, that type of like self-reflection and like being honest about the limits of your project, it's really important, because that's how you're going to know how to improve. And with Xano, it's the opposite. They're just telling you, oh, it's private, like as if it's an on or an off switch, which is freaking absurd. Yeah, these guys, I don't know, man. They're not the only project like this. They use privacy as a marketing gimmick. It's to them, it's like they're trying to take advantage of people and their virtue signaling privacy. That's really what they're doing. They're sick people. like that type of mindset where you're not actually putting in the work and like convincing people, oh yeah, this is private, and not like understanding concepts. I think that's crazy. And unfortunately, we have a lot of projects like that, and people who are using this to their advantage. So to give some examples, you know, Jeff Berwick. Yeah, that guy's notorious for doing stuff where he'll just like promote a project. Oh yeah, privacy is really important. And it's just a pump and dump. You know, he did that with multiple cryptocurrencies. And, you know, you have people like that. John McAfee, that guy, he was notorious for it back in the day. He's kind of, he's had, you know, after he passed, he's been kind of glorified, but back in the day, he was a real scumbag when it came to cryptocurrency. He would hype up crap all the time, you know. These people have always existed, and yeah, it's a real shame. I mean, with Xano, no one's going to be talking about this project in the future. It's going to just, you know, I think it's really at its peak right now, and it's going to kind of just, as you said, like, you know, linking to my article where I asked, right, like, how is Xano being used today, right? People aren't using it, right? They're just buying it and hoping for speculation. You need to have that, like, movement of people actually wanting to use something, and no one's excited to use Xano. You know, it's just, it's a flavor of the month or flavor of the cycle kind of privacy coin, quote unquote. And yeah, it's going to be replaced by the next thing next cycle. Probably Tari will be the next one or whatever. And or DarkFi or whatever. You know, you'll hear about this new project and everyone's going to be hyping it up. And, you know, maybe it will be good. I don't know. But I could tell you, based on my knowledge of Xano, the people behind it, it's not that serious of a project. And how they reacted recently to the disclosure of network security not being good at all. They, like, okay, to give you guys an example, you can't even use Tor with Xano, which I wasn't even aware of until this vulnerability disclosure.
Because you'd assume you could.
Yeah, I just assumed, because, like, I think they're kind of like a fork of Monero, or like it's involved in the same kind of area. I kind of just assumed they had either Tor or I2P support. You can't even use it. I'm like, wait, what? They don't have Dandelion Plus either, which helps ClearNet OPSEC. Kind of just to really briefly summarize it. Like, not like having those things is a real problem. But what's even worse is when they're confronted with this, they're just like, oh, just use a VPN. It's like, what? That, like, huh? That's your solution? Gigantic red flag. I mean, like, that's like completely absurd. Because, like, yeah, like, there's use cases where using a VPN is fine, but like that's your blanket security solution for network privacy. What? Like, it's amateur hour, man. And the fact that that's what their official team put out, I mean, gigantic red flags, really.
Yeah, to me, that is honestly one of the bigger red flags for me when I look at things, because you see where their priorities fundamentally are. Are they actually interested in moving the envelope on security, on privacy, or whatever the project's about? Because it's not just this. You see this everywhere.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, you do see it quite often when even, you know, somebody is an influencer and say they got something wrong. And instead of admitting, you know, what they got was wrong, it's like, oh, well, it doesn't matter anyways. And the truth of the matter is, I think authenticity actually does matter these days. And it's such a hard thing, you know, a hard line to walk, because at the same time, you have to try things. And everybody acknowledges that not everything you try is going to work out. But there is a difference between a good faith effort and kind of just a lazy cash grab. And one of the things I find interesting about how you kind of walk the walk is, you know, I think people should listen to Anti-Moonboy News as a way of staying up on various parts about the cryptocurrency market, but especially Monero. But like,
it airs every Monday, by the way.
Yeah, and you take super chats through Monero with XMR chat, I believe it's called. And this is a perfect example where, to me, I love low stakes examples of how to actually use these tools. For instance, I've seen many people running their independent blogs and there's a Monero address. You can just tip to that. Yeah, that itself is not going to upend financial tyranny across the board, but it's one of the many necessary steps towards actually flourishing that foundation. And I think it's great that not only, you know, are you using it, but you're actually making it, you know, something people can actually see you doing, and that allows them to put it into practice.
Well, I guess I recorded on like Sunday, but it's released every Monday. It's called Anti-Moonboy News. You can find it at antimoonboy.com. I'm also on like Spotify and stuff, but RSS feed if you're based. but yeah, like XMR chat, like I started using that, I guess, at like the very beginning. Like this guy makes a service where you have like basically a donation page, and people send you Monero with like a question or a comment, and that's it. It's perfect. It's a super chat, basically. And in fact, you can actually sync it with OBS now, so you can have actually live donations coming in too, which is really cool. And by the way, you should consider adding XMR chat. I would love to see that, because it's a great way to, like, you know, add, like, have people excited to, you know, like answer, or have you answer questions, you know what I mean? Or give you a shout out or whatever. It's just a great way to like connect with the fans. And I'm having like people who have donated in the past come back, and, you know, by building that like culture and stuff, it all keeps going forward, right? Like, you know, you told me at the beginning of the show that you've been listening to me for a while. Like, I didn't even know that. That's freaking awesome, though. Like, and I like that means a lot to me, you know? And like, I'm hearing that more and more. And, you know this too, where like by you putting out content all the time, you have people who reach out to you, and you're like, I'm making an impact, and it just inspires you more, right? So really with like endorsing community projects like that, it really makes a difference. And XMR chat is just like growing and growing each week. I mean, everyone's like starting to use it now. And, you know, I could see a lot of people using in the future, because it's, you know, super easy to use. It's anonymous, which is really cool. Like, you're donating and or receiving money, and it's all yours, and it's private. What's not to like about that, right?
Yeah, I definitely think it is a game changer if more people try it. And I do need a little bit of Monero to you know, put the deposit in. So I mean, if a kind listener wants to support my Monero address, I'll definitely get that started. But the thing is that I'm kind of curious what, you know, for you, how you choose what platforms to be on, because I know you're on X as Xenu, and you have, do you have a Nostr address? Do you engage in Nostr at all? I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah, I'm going to be making one soon. I've been putting it off for a while, but actually listening to your show at Corbett made me realize, like, I got to start expanding to like other platforms. I'm like completely serious about that. Like, I felt called out, like, while listening to that. I was like, oh, God. Yeah, Nostr is one I gotta get on. Probably, I don't know, probably like one of the like Twitter alternatives as well. You know, which one are you on?
Well, I self-host my own Fediverse servers, which are interoperable with Nostr.
Very cool.
I'm sure there are many based instances on the Fedi that would love to have you on there.
Yeah.
Since I'm mentioning the Fediverse, I mean, there is a Monero dev, Silverpill, who creates Mitra, which allows you to actually accept premium content through Monero donations. Actually, I had that set up for a bit when I was doing my regular show, CyberFix. And if somebody donated Monero to that address, they would get a notification kind of like through a Twitter like interface, and you could have a paywalled list of subscribers on a more social media centered interface. And what I thought that was a big game changer, because that's one way where people can be like, oh, I want to create a profile online. How do I get paid? And like, that is, you know, Monero is a game changer in this space because it just works. And I think that's kind of why the tooling is so interesting, because as I've said before, it's like you can create something relatively simple. In this case, it's Mitra, which is a Fediverse server, but there's also XMRChat. There's many other tools that by using something that does work, you can get the benefits of it. And I think it's actually a huge deal. I mean, if you wanted to set up a Mitra instance on antibootboy.com, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, I didn't even know about that. That's pretty, I'll have to look that up. That's cool. That sounds pretty cool. Nostr, like, I've had people request me to go on there, so I'm probably going to go there. And, you know, I get it. It's kind of an echo chamber, but, you know, whatever. I will say this, though. Like, so with the politics of cryptocurrency, I don't know if your listeners are aware of this. It's very tribalistic. Like, people are very cut off from talking about other cryptocurrencies. Sometimes, like, there's reasons for it where, like, some cryptocurrencies are just, they're scams. Like, we're talking about Xano. Like, I mean, I would advise people not to, like, do much with Xano. Do your own research, but, like, it's an amateur hour, right, compared to Monero. It's, like, not even close. But that being said, like, even though, like, I'm so passionate about Monero, people will say I'm just a shitcoiner because, you know, I support Monero. And it's just like, dude, I do so much, like open source stuff. Like, I can talk circles around you about, like, you know, self-hosting or, like Linux or whatever. Like, what the heck do you know? And it's usually some, like, laser-eye guy who's, like, you know, probably he just holds his Bitcoin on Coinbase. That's who's calling me. You know, it's projection, right? Yep. I will say this, though. I have seen a shift over the past year or two where even, like, hardline Bitcoiners are just like, all right, Monero's doing its thing. You know, I've seen that happen a lot more. So, you know, I used to be, like, completely against going on Nostr, but I think they kind of need some more Monero guys on there because, like, that cypherpunk soul is, it's only being held by a small collective in Bitcoin right now. And I think Monero's really pushing the envelope.
I certainly agree with that. And I mean, I kind of tuned out most of Nostr for a while. Like, I have a list of people I follow from there. But, like, yeah, the general public discussion, you know, because what I don't like about Nostr is that it has zaps. And it's kind of a weird problem where, like, people can effortlessly donate, but it's done through the Bitcoin Lightning Network and it's all custodial. And so to me, it all feels like terribly fake. And yes, you can run your own Lightning, you know, node, but, like, there are problems with running a Lightning node that I think make it not worth the effort for most people. You know, for some people, I'm sure it is. And it's tragic because I think it is genuinely hard for people to kind of get behind something that, you know, has potential, maybe. You know, I was kind of a early adopter trying out the Lightning Network, but I was very disappointed with how it worked in practice. And it's hard because many people don't want to take criticism seriously at the time when, you know, the whole hype is riding on everything. But then in hindsight, many of these people really excited about Lightning Network should have just been using Monero this entire time. And I think you're definitely right that dynamic block size is a huge part of that. Is there anything else you'd kind of like to leave us on? I know we've kind of touched on a wide variety of topics, but any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the best thing someone can do to learn about Monero is to, you know, challenge it, right? And ask yourself, how can you attack it? Like, that's how I got into Monero. And that seems like backwards, like, well, you're trying to break this cryptocurrency you're promoting. Well, yeah, you want to try and break it. You want to think outside the box with that. And what you're going to end up realizing is that there's a lot of really cool creative things that Monero does under the hood for privacy. And that the larger, you know, bigger issue really is these centralized exchanges that are, you know, collecting data on you. So if you're interested in learning more about this, I have a lot of content on my channel. Attack of the Poison Outputs is a series that I made, which is all about how Monero can be attacked and all the different ways it has been attacked. Like, for example, you might not know about this. There was a major flooding attack that happened a year ago where someone was just spamming Monero transactions, and it actually lowered the anonymity sets of people using Monero during that time. It's actually quite serious. And you can do that right now still. So it's actually a problem. It's part of the reason why Monero is upgrading from ring signatures to full chain membership proofs, which is kind of like the next technological innovation. But anyways, the point is, you can check that out on my channel, or if you're more interested in contemporary news, you know, what's happening throughout the week, I have a podcast that is released every Monday called Anti-Moonboy News. Love to have you stop by and check that out. And of course, Darknet Market Maximalism is more of like, it's kind of like a spoken word album, I guess, where I have like a written piece. You could also just read it. It's kind of just my analysis of what cryptocurrency is today and the rotten state that it's in because of the moon boys. I also got merch. If you like t-shirts.
And how are you selling the merch? Is that just through...
XMR Bazaar, actually.
Oh, nice. That's another thing I saw in a lot of different places is XMR Bazaar. I'm thinking if I do ever sell products, that's probably where I will give it a shot because that's a very interesting concept on its own. So thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great conversation. I think it is honestly quite refreshing to talk to somebody in the crypto space who really does have their head on straight. And it does mean a great deal to me that you joined me to have this conversation. Thank you everyone for listening, and I hope you all have an excellent one.